We are now going to discuss another post-implementation. On IFRS 13.
Thank you, Hans. Thank you. So we have a number of papers for this discussion on what could possibly be our last meeting on IFRS 13 PIR, depending on what decisions you make today. From all the papers we have posted, really, it is paper 7A that we're going to use for discussion, and that is the paper that has questions for the board. The other papers are simply repostings of papers we have discussed either at a previous meeting in the on the PIR in January of this year or meetings further back. So there's no new information there. They are for background just to provide a complete context for the discussion. So what is our purpose today? So we are asking you to make assessments as a result of work on the post-implementation review of IFRS 13, whether IFRS 13 is working as intended, and whether you want to conduct any follow-up as a result of findings from the PIR. I wasn't really going to go through the detail of the paper to allow time for the discussions, but I will just summarize the staff assessments in this area and our recommendations. So in assessment of whether IFRS 13 is working as intended, we look at three areas primarily. We looked at whether it's providing useful information to users of financial statements. We looked at whether there are significant implementation challenges that might give rise to inconsistency in implementation. And we looked at whether there are any unexpected costs that have arisen as a result of implementation of IFRS 13. And the staff assessments overall, and I'm hoping this is no surprise to anyone given the feedback we have had, is that IFRS 13 is working as intended. The feedback has generally been very positive throughout the post-implementation review process. In particular, the feedback from the users of financial statements who have said that the standard has brought improvements to financial reporting and that the information provided is useful. Of course, having said that, there were comments about the room for improvement and in regards to usefulness of information, and in particular, we have the topics we have discussed in January, there were suggestions that there could be improvements with regards to disaggregation of information, with regards to transparency for information, and with regards to perhaps some additional information that could perhaps be useful to users of financial statements. With regards to implementation challenges, I mean, you will have heard in the feedback to PIR that although the standard is generally working well, nevertheless, there are challenges in each of the areas of focus that we have assessed in the request for information. So to remind you, this was judgments relating to assessment where the market is active and relating to assessment whether inputs in the measurement are significant and unobservable. Then this relation to the unit of account question, and also we had an assessment of highest and best use assessment for non-financial assets and fair value measurement of biological assets and unquoted equities. I'm not going to repeat all the feedback. We have already discussed this in January, but overall, just looking at the challenges and implementation, you will have seen from the paper and discussion that although there are challenges, there's also evidence from practice that has either developed or is developing to help deal with these challenges, and that in some cases the actual inconsistency in implementation is perhaps not that great. And then finally, what we looked at is whether there were any unexpected costs, and you will have recalled from our discussion in January that there were a number of, number three disclosures that were particularly costly to prepare, but going back to question whether these costs were unexpected. Each of these disclosures were identified as being costly at the time the board was finalizing IFRS 13, and there is a related discussion, the basis of conclusions for the standard for why the board thought that despite these costs, that these disclosures would be useful. And these disclosures indeed were found to be useful. So again, the staff's assessment that although some aspects are costly, that over overall there were no unexpected costs that were risen. So looking at these three areas, usefulness, implementation challenges, and unexpected costs, the staff's overall assessment is whether that standard is working as intended. And this is really the first question to you, whether you agree with staff assessment or what is your assessment of how IFRS 13 is working.
Tak.
Yeah, thank you. Let me talk about the somehow convergence issue. There is a one requirement, of which is the quantitative disclosure of our sensitivity, which was not required by the FASB. And then I remember the paper in 7G, which was presented in January, staff conducted some research of the FASB disclosure, whether or not there is a voluntary disclosure of our quantitative analysis of sensitivity. Yes. And then the outcome of that research says that there was no company who is making voluntary disclosure of quantitative sensitivity analysis. And then in FASB's requirement, in US GAAP, they were discussing about this disclosure, and then I think they still stay on the only qualitative disclosure, not quantitative disclosure. So actually, if there was no voluntary disclosure in the US GAAP, that may indicate the information provided by this requirement is not very much useful. If it were very useful, then there might be some pressure to the U.S. company to do the voluntary disclosure, but no one is disclosing it. So I think it's worth checking whether it is really beneficial. The benefit overweight the cost. Because if you look at the feedback of this PIR, there are some comments saying that this disclosure is somehow burdensome, and not only just burdensome, it's quite difficult to do it because assumption varies, and it may indicate some confusing information. So that was the feedback we have seen. So I think, IFRS 13 overall is okay, but in this particular issue, I think we could revisit.
Maybe if I could just clarify, and you're quite right to point out, we did that research and we did not find evidence of U.S. companies doing that. And I have to say, Gary has correctly predicted the outcome of research before we even started, because I think you said the burden of providing any voluntary disclosure is such that there is hardly any provided. But that is, I guess, one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that we did find evidence of voluntary disclosure, not in the companies applying US GAAP, but in the companies that have investment properties. Mm-hmm. Because if you recall, the board has, in IFRS 13, decided to make this requirement mandatory for financial instruments only. Mm-hmm. It's not mandatory for non-financial instruments.
Right.
Yet, despite this, we have found evidence of a significant trend, and this is confirmed by work on our taxonomy team, who have done more extensive review because they are currently conducting a common practice review for relating to IFRS 13. And they said there is a significant number of companies that provide this disclosure for their investment properties, which are non-financial assets. And also, maybe just to reiterate, that feedback that we have received from the users is that this information is useful. Mm-hmm. But there are all these caveats that you mentioned. You're quite right. Mm-hmm. There are also suggestions that it can be made better. It is the fact that it is costly. So I think there's kind of different aspects you can, different ways you can look at this.
I have a question. It may be more about the recommendations for follow-up. So if we're being strict about discussing only question one, are we, or are we moving on?
I was trying to, but if, I mean, I don't want to, yeah.
Because my comment, I think it is working as intended, and that the research just follows up. But in respect of the recommendations for the follow-up in light of that conclusion, I have two comments, one of which is about saying, well, take the feedback about how disclosure could be improved and throw it over the wall into the primary financial statement project and or the principles of disclosure. And I think that, you know, the table that you have done, I think it's at the back of this paper, when you go through them, that makes sense for most of them, because I think most of them are about how to get improved application of the current requirements rather than about differing requirements. And so to the extent it's about how to get improved application, I think maybe we can learn something, or these may provide points of experiment. But when I get to item 6, there's a specific request. It's on page 24. The item 6, require additional disclosures for level 2 measurements. That is a request for a change to the standard. And I think we should make a decision now. I mean, maybe not this moment, this day, but now, as part of our wrap-up of the PIR, about whether or not we want to pursue making this change. Because otherwise, if we put it down and then pick it up in X undefined period of time, we're going to have to get back to speed with why people were asking for it, what's our assessment of cost benefits, et cetera. So I think we should make a decision about, we recommend that there at least is research about doing the standard setting or not. So that's the exception in terms of the follow-up. I think we should take at least a preliminary decision. And the second thing, this relates a bit to it, is the FASB work, which is you reported and assessed the changes that the FASB has made to the comparable standard, which is largely converged in paper 7E. And with respect to the historic, you know, the completed amendments, you know, I think we don't have to spend any more time on scrutiny about whether or not they change or there's something we want to incorporate. But it looks like there's an open project which included proposals that line up with that item 6 from the table. If you look at paper 7E, like Edward, on page 6, they propose making changes to require unrealized gains loss for level 2, et cetera, which is along the lines of what item 6 was. Mm-hmm. Now, reading this paper, it sounds as if they probably have decided not to do that but haven't taken a final decision. And it just seemed like there was a conclusion and said there's nothing more we have to think about from FASB when we didn't have the final outcome of their current work. And that was the further piece of information that I wanted, particularly in respect of item 6 about making changes to level 2 disclosures.
Yeah, maybe just to clarify that, Mary, my impression is FASB discussion is pretty much final. They have not finalized the amendments, and what has been reflected in paragraph 15 in paper 7E and also in paper 7A, which is in paragraph 33, is basically where they've ended up with. So what you correctly point out is that they had exposure draft which proposed more substantive additions to level 2 disclosures. However, that has been rolled back somewhat so that there is no additional disclosure requirements at the end being added to level 2, and the only additional requirement is in regards to changes in unrealized gains and losses that go through OCI relating to level 3 instrument, which now need to be separately disclosed, as well as the range and weighted average of the inputs used. But level 2 has been dropped overall.
Okay. So then it sounds like, you know, absent some startling revelation from their balloting process, we expect them to really only make the change about the OCI.
Yes.
And so therefore, when we look at the making a decision about whether we conduct at least research to do standard setting to, you know, for the level 2 disclosures, that presumably their feedback would be relevant input if we were to do research because they explored a lot of the same things. So when I go back to, I'd like to make a decision now rather than say let's put this down for 6 months or 9 months or 2 years before we make a decision about level two. And again, now doesn't mean this afternoon necessarily if we haven't done the work, but rather than picking up and putting down, let's close it out.
I mean, just to... I feel this meeting is running away from me a little bit. I mean, if I can just pause there, because there are several aspects I wanted to discuss, because we need in our, you know, report first state the board's assessment of how whether standard is working as intended. And I heard, Mary, you were comfortable with that. And maybe if I could just, if the comments, if you had comments in relation to that, if nobody else had a comments in relation to that, then maybe we can move on to discussing the follow-up, if yeah, because it's yeah, is that okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Nick, was your sorry?
So and I think I can speak because I'm going to respond to question one. Just to say, I'm nervous of making the inference that TAC made, that just because on a basis of voluntary disclosures not being made doesn't mean it's not useful to anyone. Mm-hmm. And I think the evidence we have in the PR is that it is useful. But overall, on the basis of what has been presented in the PIR, I think the standard is working well. I think we have to be wary of not tweaking it too much. Perhaps there's some small modifications we can make. But let's take care. This overall, it does seem to be working well.
Okay. Similar comments to Nick. I actually think it's time to close this project and write your final report. I do think it's working well. And keep in mind, anything that's big, which is, can always be done better. The question is, when is it sufficient? You know, you don't want the great to be the enemy of the good. I think the recommendation about to give the ones on disclosure usefulness over to the better communications team is the right way to do it. First of all, they are looking for some targeted standards level review. We got a extensive amount of work on IFRS 13 disclosures. You kind of hate to that just to languish, you know, on the shelf. You know, they may or may not choose to say we should use IFRS 13 is one of the two standards they choose to do, but it would certainly seem to be a right candidate to do so. In view of all the very recent feedback and stuff, time will tell where the staff comes back on that. But it wasn't clear to me as I'm reading recommendation 2A, I agree with give the disclosure usefulness to the team, but if they chose to do nothing with it, does it come back here, or is it just okay, that's the end of it?
Okay, so we have.
It wasn't clear how that was written.
You're doing the same violation I'm doing.
But it's all related. If you want to say it's good, I'm trying to say it's good, we don't have to do anything else, but, you know.
Okay, so clearly I should have had different strategies. So, so I should start with a question too. So, thanks for that input.
I think we can assume question one to be voted yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Favor two absent.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, just thank you. Thank you very much. So, moving on to follow up, and I'm not going to do long tee up. We already started discussion, but just to reiterate a couple of things, and one is that doing PIR does not presume there ought to be any follow-up, and this is also stated in the due process handbook, which says it can be several different outcomes, including do nothing. So there is no requirement or expectation to do anything, and what can be done as a result of PIR can be a number of different things. You know, it can be major amendment to a standard. It can be minor amendments, such as narrow scope improvements. It can be development of some supporting materials or other kind of educational activities, or it can be combination of those things or none of them. So what we have done, there isn't really criteria in our due process for how to go about deciding what to do after PIR, but there are criteria for these different standard setting activities. There are criteria for major amendments. There are criteria for narrow scope improvements. And we also have some discussions about supporting materials. So in the papers, we have actually used those criteria to go through our analysis. And I think our analysis showing that there is no deficiency in the standard in any way that would justify any kind of major amendment to the standard. With narrow scope amendments, we thought there are three areas that are worth considering, and one being the improving usefulness of disclosures, which, you know, both of you have touched upon, and to decide whether to, I mean, you have seen, obviously, our recommendation is that this work is put within the scope of the pod project simply because we in a staff view didn't think it was efficient to have two projects simultaneously working on similar things. But then at the same time, responding to your point, Gary, we wanted to have some kind of trace and accountability that, you know, just the fact that this is the expression you use, Mary, throw over the wall, topic, it doesn't mean that, you know, whatever is decided there, this gets forgotten, which is actually the reason we developed this table in the appendix, so that, you know, Paul, Tim and Catherine and I have already had lots of discussions amongst ourselves how we go about this in different scenarios to make sure that whatever, you know, Pod will decide what is the best for that project, but then how, you know, have separate discussion of how that decision reflects on the outcome of the PIR, and as a result of that decision, if there is a need to revisit any of the areas that are maybe not being specifically captured by POD. So we will, because in past, perhaps we haven't done as good job with that when things get moved from one project to another. So we will work to make sure there is this audit trail, so to speak, so that issues don't just get forgotten, and maybe just point to what you said earlier, Mary, let's decide now. Post-implementation review is a research project, so it is never envisaged as a part of this project that the board would decide on any standard setting. But I guess it depends how you look at it. You might decide you want to specifically look at, you know, having additional disclosure requirements, but certainly having additional disclosure requirements would not be result of PIR, it would be result of separate project, whatever
that is. And all I was concerned about is the implication that we've identified possible standard setting in item 6 that would require amendments, and then we just kind of leave it floating as opposed to saying, do we think we want to recommend follow-up on this? And I'm not particularly driving for, yes, let's go ahead and do this. I just want to know whether it's a someday if we get around to it, we might possibly think of it, or let's decide we're going to, you know, do the research to decide whether or not to add a project to our agenda, or let's decide that it's interesting, but at this time we didn't hear enough that we are going to actively pursue it even with research. You know, and if that needs a bit more work for us to make that, okay, not today, but let's not just say someday in the future we'll make a decision about it.
Okay. So, yeah, you can tell us what you think about that. And maybe just in relation to other two areas which we considered potentially, you know, recommending some further work. One is being the P times Q, and, you know, I have to emphasize that ASAF was, for example, very much in favor of board taking this on board. But when we looked at all pros and cons and what would might happen as a result of this, and given the long history that the board has in discussing this topic, the staff's assessment was really that the cost of this work would exceed the benefits, which is why we did not recommend this to be taken forward. And then the final area that we considered was the work on judgments and assessment of whether the market is active. But there also we did not think that a principle-based guidance such as inevitable is in IFRS 13 could perhaps resolve the questions in any sufficient way, because this is something that judgment always, where judgment always needs to be exercised, which is why on balance and considering the work valuation profession is doing here, on the balance, the staff didn't recommend anything. So what did staff recommend is now the question whether you agree with to move or to transfer the recommendations on disclosures to the POD project, and in relation to other areas, continue close liaison with valuation profession. which we already have, and continue meeting with them and monitor developments in practice so that we can alert the board if something significant happens. And in addition to that, the staff does not recommend anything further. So I guess first is whether you agree with recommendation regards to disclosures, and then follow on from that, do you agree or do you want staff to do any further follow-up as a result?
Sue?
I do agree with your recommendations, including, and I'm not sure what it means when we say that we want it to go to POD, but if it's that we should sort of particularly flag looking at the drafting of the disclosure requirements in IFRS 13 as a good potential project for that team to assess when they come back and bring that analysis to us, then yes, I would agree that that makes sense. I think one other aspect that that might make sense as well is there's a lot of, this PIR brought up some of the questions around unrealised for level two. I think it's interesting that the FASB got such sort of pushback from preparers on that, but we haven't done that analysis ourselves yet. But I think a lot of questions come up in our world about the extra information that might be useful about realised and unrealised in the context of fair value movements. I'm thinking about some of the stuff that's links into IFRS 9. So I think in addition to the sort of drafting aspects, which I think are relevant for POD, maybe we should also be talking to the Better Communications, the PFS team, about whether there's anything we should think about in terms of presentation to do with realised, unrealised, that sort of has a tangential link into this level two, level three work as part of the presentation aspects of that project.
Nick?
So yesterday we made a decision in terms of the POD project that we would work on some board guidelines, and then we'd have an iterative approach in terms of applying those to a test standard. It feels a bit like to me today we're identifying that test standard already by default through this process, and I'm a little wary of. I'm not sure
well,
that we've done that.
Thrown into the mix.
Yeah, I'm
analysis.
Not sure we've had a kind of holistic view in terms of what that test project should or standard should be, and here I feel like it's the recommendation is almost saying it should be this standard. So I wasn't ready to make that decision yet.
Which is why I was trying to be careful with my wording, because my reading was that what you're suggesting is that it be highlighted as a potential candidate for the analysis that the POD team would bring back to us, so it wouldn't be determinative today that we'd be saying, yes, this is the one, but that would go through that analysis. And be sort of flagged as something we'd seen as a potential. Look at Catherine to make sure she's not looking daggers. She's nodding, so that's
which
good.
Which is fair enough, because I guess any standard could be could fit
but,
into
but
that.
But given with, I guess the special thing for me about this is we do have specific feedback on some of the challenges that seem to have come from drafting, so it seems like it's got we've got an extra set of information.
Yeah, I guess then I'd be interested in the contingency if we didn't select this one as being our first. So that's one issue. And the second issue is around moving stuff to PFS in terms of aggregation, disaggregation. I know they're looking at those issues. They're looking at those issues really around items that are on the face, largely of the performance statement at the moment. And I'm not sure there's necessarily such a natural fit in terms of looking at our disaggregation of various assets and liabilities with the notes of a detailed disclosure standard. Don't see the obvious read across.
Can I just comment on the sort of handover to principles of disclosure and back? And I think an important piece of that is that if it ends up not being the candidate that's selected, that the package that's put in front of the board at that stage gives the board a reminder of everything that was sort of in the board's mind at this stage, so that if it's not picked up in principles of disclosure, the board can then decide, yes, we want to do something, go ahead, or no, we're comfortable that it's being dropped completely at this point.
So we would have a second chance to look at it.
Yeah.
That might be necessary. Yeah. Daryl.
So nothing to add to what's been said on 2A. Just on 2B, on the idea of working more with the valuation profession. I think we've heard, and this is perhaps more pronounced in the emerging economies, that there is a big gap in the space, and people were looking to us to do something potentially, or to someone else to do it. I agree with the recommendation as is. I think it makes sense that this be housed in the valuation space rather than in the ISB space. I think they have the skills and the abilities to help. But I think ideally we should try and explore as we go through this process, firstly highlighting or making it clearer to everybody what we are doing with valuation professionals, how closely we're working with them, and then seeing if we can explore with them whether or not their material can be made more available so that the emerging economies and others, I think, who've had problems with this are able to access the material more easily. I think it's just a matter of highlighting. I think it is the right answer. It's just a matter of making sure that people know that is what's happening.
Ms. Wazza.
Well, I support the staff recommendation. I mentioned yesterday that I would look favorably having a pilot case in the principle of disclosures being an amendment that was required for other reasons. Now, I also agree and support the view that when we select the candidates for those tests, standard level review test, I also support that we do it with in the search of having the most efficient test as possible. So there will be eventually some things to balance, and so I really support that it be done without preconceived idea on the outcomes. Now, we mentioned here two projects. So my understanding is that with the principle of disclosure, the standard set review, once we have set the guidance and tried to implement it, we would have the matter for an exposé draft. Where it relates to the primary financial statement, we still don't know what kind of due process document would be the next one. So I would place a word of caution here so that we don't delay addressing the issue identified in this post-implementation review in too long a future.
Okay. Dan Chang?
Thank you. I just to mention again, I have same comments as Dale said. I think there is a demand from the emerging economy, and I remember that the first emerging economic group meeting, the topic discussed is the implementation issues arising from emerging economy, and they do need some support or material to help them to implement of IFRS 13. So I think I agree that we should continue liaising with the board and the valuation profession, but afterwards, what kind of work we are going to do or what kind of support or material we are going to provide, I think we still need an open mind and to maybe to do something to meet that gap which emerging economies do need. Yeah.
I was going to bring up my point in relation to question three, but it follows on from what John Cho was just saying. And I think we've had some success with our case studies around improving disclosure. And I note in the PIR for 13 that there's a lot of requests for help with guidance and education materials, which are quite difficult for us to do for a number of reasons. But I did wonder if there's something we could do around judgments and estimates in that case study type format, so not creating examples and illustrative guidance and not training materials, but more on the lines of the case studies where we took other people's material and collated it and presented it and said, here's examples of how others are doing it. Just wonder whether there's an opening around judgments and estimates that we might think about having case study examples from existing material that others do. And that would be part of our response here to people asking for more help. And so I make that suggestion, and it follows on from what John Cho just said.
And I'd like to follow on from that, and I don't know whether it's a good precedent or not, but But in the financial crisis, we set up this expert advisory panel, which gave some sort of guidance on fair value before any standard setting was done. And that guidance, the way that was developed, basically was a kind of case study format that said, what are people doing in practice and what do we think is sort of good practice at the moment? So whether that's a precedent we want to think about following or not, it's at least something that existed in the past.
So, and just to clarify, you were saying that rather than leaving it to POD, who have said that they will first assess whether the effect of the first set of case studies and then decide whether to do any further and what those would be, that rather than doing that, you would actually do case studies directly as a follow-on from the EIR.
That's something we could think about, because waiting to see whether the original set of case studies has had any impact, it's going to be very difficult for us to tell. It's going to be extremely difficult for us to measure the impact of those case studies. So if that was the hurdle, we had to see some positive impact before we did another set of case studies, I think that then we probably wouldn't proceed.
Might be a good idea, but I just want to caution, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, so we may.
I think it's more work than making our own guidance.
Okay. So
we have to find these people, we have to contact them, we have to translate their information into something that is comparable, acceptable. It was a lot of work.
Mm. So we could decide not to do it because of the cost-benefit, but it's better to make that decision than say we'll wait and see for the positive evidence from the first set, because I just think it's hard to get that evidence. It's just something to put on the table in response to PIR, the call for assistance on how to do it, how to do judgments and estimates.
Nick?
Sorry, just looking for some further clarification on the issue of taking the question of disaggregation and aggregation over to the PFS project. Does that extend the scope of that project? And I know we're looking at how we can do this in a timely fashion already. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if that's going to push things out further.
I mean, when we have, and I will speak with PFS hat on if that's okay, when we look at the scope of PFS project, there are aspects of it that are specific to individual financial statements, and there are aspects that go across. And work on disaggregation and aggregation is meant to be a work that is applicable across the primary financial statements and notes. I do know practically discussion on function versus nature is really mostly relevant to the P&L, but there are also higher level principles of disaggregation that could be transportable.
In that respect, it shouldn't extend our timelines.
I just can't see how we would develop something that would help that would be necessarily different. I just can't see efficiency in working on this separately, but that's just,
Just repeat my previous comments about what kind of thing we could provide. I think the feedback we got from PIR, especially from the emerging economists, quite positive, actually. They support our standard. They think that standards work well. And the main thing they need, they simply would like more guidance. So, and also maybe educational material. This is what they need. They satisfy our standards, but they would like have more material, education material to support them. And with regard to limited resources, actually we did not start from zero. We do that still, as I think Peter mentioned, during the financial crisis, we prepared, I think, a very good document by those expert panel. That document could, this is one, and also during financial crisis, FSB also provided some guidance to address some, how to fair value those inactive market, those assets inactive market, something like that. And also we have provided educational material with regard to fair value of unquoted equity instrument. And also, I think EG provided some documents previously. I think based on those documents, we can pick up several main issues, provided some education material come by, as Anne said, that maybe there are some case studies that could provide support. And I think it's better because, as I know that the education material for fair value measurement of unquoted equity instrument, that's called Chapter 1, I think, as I remember that. But the people are waiting for where is the Chapter 2 or Chapter 3 here. So I think we can identify some main issues we received from feedback of the PIR, and if possible, work together with valuation profession and provide some supporting material. I don't think it will take too long time, and with regard, based on current material we have got, yeah. So this is, I think we can do something with regard to follow-up, what kind of follow-up work we should do.
Could I maybe just clarify this liaison with valuation profession, and because I think it goes very much to what you were recommending, and, you know, there is International Valuation Standards Board, IVSC, so they are... we have been in contact with them throughout the process of post-implementation review, and they have recently had their own agenda consultation process during which they consulted us, and we provided them feedback from the PIR. So what I understand is that they have taken on board some of the areas that we have found people find challenging, such as biological assets, and they have established their own working groups to actually work to develop guidance that will help with measurements in these challenging areas. I think they're also looking at some of the areas of judgments, and we are meeting with them. We as a staff will continue to have a contact with them, and just when we were thinking about this, it just seemed like a more natural, better way for this guidance to be provided by people who are actually valuing these assets on day-to-day basis, rather than, with all due respect, standard setters here who may be not so close about, palm oil and trees, except for Daryl here, perhaps. And it was quite interesting discussions because, we don't know much about the detailed valuations, and when speaking to them, they say, well, actually, some of these challenges are very much similar to challenges relating to other assets, such as inventories, and look, we can transport these principles from here to there, and we can maybe help with transfer of this knowledge, and they seemed really the best people to provide that than from that to be pushed from somewhere like here.
Is there palm oil in South Africa?
There isn't, but it's been... I got dragged into the debate by being in the wrong place at the wrong time, I think.
Yeah, can I just clarify what I was saying about the expert panel? So my point was that was a kind of precedent for something like a case study format. Yeah. Most of the actual content of that document subsequently ended up in IFRS 13, so there's not content waiting around for us to pick up from that, but the format that's been used before.
I just want to perhaps and agree 100% with what you've said, and I think it goes beyond. So I think to the extent that the valuation profession and particularly the international, whatever they are, can lead the work in this space, I think that's really important. It's not just because that's where the expertise lies. It's also because it is very difficult for us to get involved in this kind of educational material because of the circular effect it has on what we're doing. What I think we should be doing is making sure that users of our financial statements are aware this material exists and know where to go and look for it. But the less we can be directly involved in the development, the better, I think.
Okay, I would like to get close to answering the specific questions, Aida. Yeah. Mary?
In terms of further follow-ups, I support the staff recommendation, I think, where we're heading, to not develop guidance examples ourselves on the area, even in the areas that the PIR confirmed were areas difficult application and judgment. We were just talking about biological, and another is highest and best use. But I think that's the reason we're not doing it. Something I would like to avoid perpetuating in the document that feeds back is saying, because there isn't evidence of inconsistent application. And I think some of the statements in here about how people have dealt with that, you know, or what we've observed about there not being diversity in practice could equally be evidence of poor application standard. I don't know that that is, but I'm just saying I think we have to think very carefully. I support the staff about what we say. I support the staff conclusion that we should not pursue a work stream at this time of developing application guidance for making up judgments in these difficult areas. But let's be careful in how, you know, what we express as the reasons and the implications we draw from the evidence we collected.
So, Aida, can you end, and then Aida, can you lead us through the questions? Yeah.
Aida, paragraph 42, the staff conclusion is no further work on the P times Q issue. Did you have any thoughts on how we're going to explain our conclusion and where we got to, given that this has been on the agenda, being had a lot of attention, and there are some people that feel very strongly about it?
I mean, yes, we have spent lots of time thinking about it, and I think the actual fact that the board has spent 3 years on this is an argument in itself, I think, and that's kind of what we portrayed here. So I was really going to use explanation we have in this paragraph, that it was really cost-benefit decision, or, you know, the staff see it as a cost-benefit decision if the board agrees.
Okay,
so the questions were, so we covered the first question. So the second question was whether you agree with the staff's recommendation for follow-up. So given Nick's comment, I will take this maybe in two chunks. One is a follow-up to the POD project, and I will take PFS maybe separately if we want have a different use. So who agrees with staff's recommendations that relevant findings relating to usefulness of disclosures are taken over by lovely Catherine sitting over there?
As long as she's comfortable with it.
Considered by her. We're not saying she has to deal with it.
11 in favor, 2 absent.
And now the findings relating to aggregation and disaggregation. Who agrees with this being considered as a part of PFS project?
It's me.
Thank you.
12 in favor, 2 absent.
Okay. So who agrees that we continue to liaise with valuation profession and monitor guidance in practice or developments in practice?
Uh-huh. 12 in favor.
Yeah. Who wants the staff to consider any other follow-up as a result of this PIR? This is the last question. Do you want to consider any other follow-up?
That is not the case.
Okay. So this was the last meeting when I first sat in PIR. What we will do next is we will work on the report and feedback statements, and you will, as all board members, will have opportunity to review this document before it's finalized.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Aida.
Good job. Okay. Thank you.